Hey, what's going on? I'm Scott. Welcome to the show. How are you guys doing? Oh, well, good, good. Yes, isn't that hilarious? I was pretending I could hear you say, "We're doing great, Scott. Thanks for asking." Oh, well, I hope things are going all right. I'm Scott. This is my show. I got Will Grigg coming up on the show. And Will, he wrote a thing, and it ain't about the cops. It's about anti-Muslim bigotry. You know, I was just reading this thing over at The Intercept a moment before going on today by Murtaza Hussein, friend of the show. And the article is about Bill Maher and how this guy's not edgy, he's just a bigot. And so I was thinking, yeah. That's right. But anyway, so Will Grigg, he's got an article along those lines, only the guys that Will Grigg is after here, they are far worse than stupid old Bill Maher. These are the guys who say that the only solution is to kill all the Muslims. And yes, that's their final solution. And anyway, it's important to, first of all, make sure that that stuff does not go unchallenged, but especially I think it's useful to attack that kind of thing from the right. And Will Grigg, honestly, he's pretty much plumb line libertarian now, but he's certainly, you know, is personally a conservative man and formerly, you know, comes from the right anyway. And so, in other words, you don't, the whole Bill Maher argument that, you know, liberals are just naive and whatever, and they just hate America so much they side with the other side, who are actually these horrible right-wing religious zealots who would destroy them all, and all this kind of argument is all moot against Will Grigg. Because he's not from the left. But he's really good at hating bigotry and cracking down on it, especially coming from the powerful. And so that's why, I don't know if he even mentions Bill Maher in his article. Bill Maher is completely besides the point. He's going after the right and the worst parts of the religious right. And, you know, I don't know. You gotta admit, the terrorism business is a good business to be in, whether you're the Pentagon or any part of the executive branch, whether you're right-wing preachers or arms industrialists, media hacks, Republican and Democratic Party officials, and whatever. I mean, this thing is, it's the perfect perpetual motion machine. And especially as long as they keep blaming Islamic extremism for being the root of our problem, then they're going to continue to generate Islamic extremism and then oppose it. So, anyway, I don't want to get too far into it. That's just setting you up for the great Will Grigg interview coming up. And like always, Will Grigg, he doesn't go ahead and put pen to paper until he's serious as hell. This one is called Crush the Seed of Ishmael, a Final Solution to the Muslim Problem. Whoa. And that's just the headline. It's a hell of a piece, man. And that's why I'm bringing him on the show, so that you'll hear him talk about it, so that you'll think to yourself, man, I really should go to Will Grigg's website, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, and copy-paste that link, huh? And, you know, read what it says, the article there, too, not just share it. A lot of times I think people share things without reading it. I saw where Ron Paul's, you know, robot or whatever tweeted out and Facebooked out Tom Wood's interview of me, which was cool. Thank you very much, Ron Paul's robot that runs his Facebook and Twitter thing, for doing that. That's awesome. Because Tom ran it at Voices for Liberty, I think is what happened there. So it got a few retweets and this and that. But I went and looked at the Facebook page. I got the Google alert And I went and looked at the Facebook page, and about two or three of the comments were from people who even heard the interview at all. All the rest of the comments were just completely inane. I won't even describe them. They're worse than inane. And people don't, and they were sharing it, and liking it, and commenting on it, but they weren't clicking on it. They were just talking. Yeah, well, anyway, I want you to read this Will Grigg piece. That's all I'm really trying to say. Read Will Grigg. Read everything Will Grigg writes. Why don't you? Maybe you do already. In which case, congratulations, you're doing the right thing. Reading Will Grigg all the time. All right. So, yeah. Sheldon Richman has a new piece out. I'll talk about this for a minute because I don't think I can talk about it for a very long time. I only have a minute or so worth of stuff to say about it, I think. This is called A Foreign Policy by and for Knaves. And I don't know if you guys are familiar. Maybe if you're interested in the paleoconservative and the libertarian movements, you know a little bit about this. But our good friend, the Tory anarchist, Dan McCarthy, editor of the American Conservative magazine, that's the anti-war right, he wrote a thing in defense of empire and saying the only reason there's real liberalism in the world is because first the British and then the American empires protected security with fire. You got to have a lot of stability and long-term security for freedom and liberalism. And he's, yes, it's the American Conservative magazine. I don't mean Barack Obama liberalism. I mean Thomas Jefferson, tiny little L liberalism. Free markets and democracy in the most general sense, in the British and American style, meaning mercantilism and fascism and war all the time and some democracy. You know? That requires, and for all the good we've gotten out of it, that requires a world empire. And thank goodness for the British Empire, after the Americans declared independence from it anyway, for keeping the world at bay so that America could develop liberalism. Anyway. And then the American Empire, of course, took up from the Brits. Now, the point of this is this. It's not just a thing that he wrote. It's a thing that he wrote, and then Bob Murphy responded, but then later Sheldon Richman also responded. And Sheldon, I think, he mentions Bob Murphy and his arguments and his, but I think Sheldon had the more kind of comprehensive response to Dan McCarthy saying, well, that's no good, because what about Robert Higgs and the Ratchet Effect and all this kind of stuff? And war being the health of the state and the state being the enemy of liberty and all of that. Well, so Dan McCarthy responded. And I actually didn't read it. Should go back. But I've now read, as of this morning, Sheldon's response to Dan's response. And I'm not going to tell you and spoil the fun for you or whatever, but it's called A Foreign Policy by and for Knaves. He starts out quoting David Hume. And I think he makes his case well. And, you know, it's basically that, hey, if it's really true that, you know, America's international trading relationships with other countries are dependent upon this, you know, vastly superior naval force, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, well, then tough. I guess we just can't have all this open trade. We'll just have to figure out how to have a free society and trade with the Canadians or whatever. Fine. But empire is far more harm than good. And, of course, there's no reason, I don't think, to believe that you need a single global authority like the Brits or the Americans to rule the seas in order to have security. Maybe back in the past, pirates and wooden ships and this and that, but we're about five eras later now when it comes to that kind of thing, aren't we? Like, for example, Walmart, which imports so much stuff from China. Shouldn't they have to pay for their own security? Certainly they could afford it. And if they can't afford it, well then, tough. They'll just have to buy American brands instead of socializing the cost of their security onto the backs of everybody else by hiring the Navy to protect their shipments. Right? I mean, what is this, Russia or something? Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Like I say, the great Will Grigg is going to be here on the show. All right, let's talk about Pakistan here for a minute. U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan killed 26 people over 5 days. Six different strikes, pound Waziristan, kill, quote, suspects. The Obama administration seems to be precipitously escalating the drone war against Pakistan's tribal areas this week. Jesus. This is by Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. News.antiwar.com. U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan killed 26 over 5 days. The Obama administration seems to be precipitously escalating the drone war against Pakistan's tribal areas this week, and today launched yet another strike, killing three more unidentified people in North Waziristan. This makes six different strikes across Waziristan in the past 5 days, killing 26 people overall. One was reportedly an Uzbek commander, but none had yet been publicly named by either U.S. or Pakistani officials. Pakistani intelligence officials have labeled every single person slain in the strikes as a, quote, suspect, but have offered no evidence backing up those claims. The strategy was common during the previous Zardari-run government, which had secret deals with the U.S. to back the drone strikes. Yet Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif ran on a promise to end the drone strikes and had been loudly critical of them in past months, to the point the strikes had virtually halted. The U.S. seems to be escalating anew, but so far there's little indication that the Sharif government cares. Same old dirty deal, right? Okay, you can kill the people you're after in our country as long as you kill the people that we want you to kill too. Shake on it, dude. That's America's deal with Pakistan. So we're killing, presumably, they're hunting Haqqani Network types or Arab-Afghan presumed friends of Zawahiri or some crap. And then in exchange, they kill leaders of the Pakistani Taliban and whatever other interests are threatening the Pakistani government's interests. However accurately described there. So, there you go. 26 killed. And now here's the thing about that. Did you know there was a thing about that? Here it goes. Check it out. It turns out that actually the drone attacks are killing 49 innocent people for every known terrorist. And then by known terrorists, you got to figure that that's a pretty loose description. Sure as hell doesn't mean somebody convicted by a court with a, you know, burden of proof on the prosecution or anything like that. America's deadly double-tap drone attacks are killing 49 people for every known terrorist in Pakistan. And it was yesterday's guest, Clive Stafford Smith, who his group Reprieve went and helped do this study, and then Stanford and New York universities helped work on it as well. And I don't know, pardon me, I don't know why the best version of the story I have in my tabs this week is from the Daily Mail, but anyway, it's good enough. It's by Leon Watson at the Daily Mail. Just one in 50 victims of America's deadly drone strikes in Pakistan are terrorists, while the rest are innocent civilians, a new report claimed today. The authoritative joint study by Stanford and New York universities concludes that men, women, and children are being terrorized by the operations 24 hours a day. The authors lay much of the blame on the use of the, quote, double-tap strike, where a drone fires one missile and then a second as rescuers try to drag victims from the rubble. One aid agency said they had a six-hour delay before going to the scene. The tactic has cast such a shadow of fear over strike zones that people often wait for hours before daring to visit the scene of an attack. Investigators also discovered that communities live in fear of the drones were suffering severe stress and related illnesses. Many parents had taken their children out of school because they were so afraid of a missile strike. Today, campaigners savaged the use of drones, claiming they were destroying a way of life. Clive Stafford Smith, director of the charity Reprieve, which helped interview people for the report, said, quote, "This shows that drone strikes go much further than simply killing innocent civilians. An entire region is being terrorized by the constant threat of death from the skies." There have been at least 345 strikes in Pakistan's tribal areas near the border with Afghanistan in the past 8 years. These strikes are becoming much more common. Mira Shahzad Akbar, a Pakistani lawyer who represents victims of drone strikes, told The Independent, "In the past, it used to be a one-off, every now and then. Now, almost every other attack is a double tap. There is no justification for it." The study is the product of 9 months' research and more than 130 interviews. It is one of the most exhaustive attempts by academics to understand and evaluate Washington's drone wars. Remember now, Eric Rudolph, the Olympic Park bomber and the abortion clinic bomber. Well, certainly in the case of the abortion clinics, that was his signature. That has always been characterized by the American government as the very worst form of terrorist attack, setting a second bomb to then wound or kill the first responder heroes who come to try to save innocent victims and kill them too. But you know what? It makes sense to the U.S. government to do it that way in Pakistan for the exact same reasons and in the exact same way that it made sense for Eric Rudolph, the murderer terrorist, to do the same thing. Because see, they're terrorists. They're murderers. Sorry to stop the news just to point out the obvious here. But in case you don't remember, before this was Obama's policy, this was the kind of thing the U.S. government accused others of doing all the time, characterized as the very worst thing that someone could do. How evil can you get? You're going to set a bomb and then set a second one to go off in 10 minutes. Or drop a second bomb as soon as the ambulance arrives. What in the hell is that? What is this, Israel? Despite assurances the attacks are, quote, surgical, researchers found barely 2% of their victims are known militants, and that the idea that the strikes make the world a safer place for the U.S. is ambiguous at best. Researchers added that traumatic effects of the strikes go far beyond fatalities, psychologically battering a population which lives under the daily threat of annihilation from the air and ruining the local economy. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed. Guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm live here, noon to 3 Eastern Time on Liberty Radio Network. Full interview archives and full show archives and all kind of other stuff is over there, ScottHorton.org, including the chat room. Join up the chat room during the show. ScottHorton.org/chat. All right. Our guest today is our good friend William Norman Grick. He keeps the blog Pro Libertate at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And usually he's writing about police abuse and the just absolutely out of control domestic police state here in America. But boy, oh boy, Am I glad that you decided to tackle this topic, done as only you could have done it, Will. It's just great. Crush the seed of Ishmael, a final solution to the Muslim problem. Obviously echoing the Nazis' rhetoric about the Jews in the Holocaust and World War II. Welcome to the show. How are you doing there?
I'm doing great, Scott. Thank you so much for your kind words.
Well, you know, you're just the best at writing stuff, and this is a topic where, you know, it's really usually liberals and left-wingers who are good on this, and so it's good to have your, I think, kind of formerly right-wing, now more libertarian, but still never left liberal point of view to take on this problem here and maybe in a way, explain it in a way maybe that people can understand, maybe people who are predisposed to kind of, you know, more or less at least accept some of the premises of the arguments that you're attacking here, if not their conclusions. So anyway.
I hope so.
Yeah, very important stuff. So who's Ishmael? Who's got to crush him? And what Muslim problem? And what are you talking about? What am I talking about?
In the book of Genesis, we read about Ishmael as being Abram, the future Abraham's son, by way of a concubine named Hagar. And Ishmael is conventionally considered to be the father of the Arab ethnic cohort. And if you talk to a devout Muslim, chances are he will identify himself as a child of Abraham by way of Ishmael. Now, in some, but by no means all, precincts of evangelical Christianity, you'll find people who will assert that because of this dodgy bloodline, that Arabs in general, Muslims in particular, have to be looked upon as the inveterate enemies of God and of God's people, meaning Christians and Jews. And there is a rather splenetic character who deems himself some kind of a pastor by the name of Gary Cass, who used to be associated with a number of very high-profile ministries, who has written an essay in which he says that it is nothing less than the sacred duty of Christians to crush the seed of Ishmael, the vicious seed of Ishmael, in order to bring about the triumph of God's purposes. And what that means is that we have to recognize, supposedly, that all Muslims everywhere are irreducibly the enemies of Christians and of all decency. They are at best latent ISIS-style deranged killers, and at worst, of course, they give full rein to those impulses. That being the case, we have three potential ways of dealing with the problem of Muslims living in the United States. The first is to convert them, and according to Mr. Cass, this is impossible because they are of the completely incorrigible seed of Ishmael. They are genetically predisposed to be vessels of wrath. They were created for that purpose. And we're not going to see a mighty move of God among them because God has ordained that these people are irredeemable. So there may be one of a family and two of a city who would be receptive to the message of the Christian gospel, but we shouldn't believe that this would be in any sense representative of a potential mass conversion. Besides that, we've heard from no less an authority than Phil Robertson, who is the patriarch of the Duck Dynasty clan and hence one of our foremost public theologians, that our choices are either to convert them or kill them, and he's not optimistic that the former is going to avail us. So we can scratch option one off that list. The second possibility is either mass sterilization of Muslims in order to deal with their fecundity, or mass expulsion of Muslims because they tend to propagate themselves faster than we could sterilize them. Given the fact that nobody is going to consent to be sterilized against his or her will, and given the fact that we're dealing with millions of people, that's not a particularly good option either, according to Mr. Cass. He, by the way, created a rather charming acronym for this element of his agenda, D-A-M-N, DAM, meaning Depart All Muslims Now. So that leaves us with what he considers to be the only biblically sound approach, which is mass violence, meaning not only, of course, defensive violence, and I am not indisposed toward the idea that there are circumstances where purely defensive violence is justified. I have great respect for pacifism. I don't happen to embrace that perspective. So I do believe in the right of armed self-defense where necessary, although I'll go to extreme lengths in order to avoid that eventuality because that is a tragedy any way you look at it. But he's talking about the idea literally of a war of extermination that would know no boundaries, because as long as these people exist in the same physical continuum with us, and as long as they are possessed of this ideology that he finds to be incurably vile, and as long as they are cursed with a genetic legacy that he considers to be dispositive, we will never know freedom or safety or peace. And that means that we have to move toward the idea of killing as many people as necessary in order to make a better world, meaning from his perspective and not mine, a Muslim-free world for our children and grandchildren. And this fellow, who has a caricatured, gravity-defying pompadour, descends upon pulpits across the country and has a great deal of influence within that strain, and it's one strain among many, I hasten to specify and emphasize, of evangelical Christianity. I believe he's of Presbyterian or Calvinist background himself. But his message resonates with the sort of people who consider Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity to be fountains of wisdom. And their numbers are many, and they're happily, I think, located toward the decaying edge of the demographic curve. I mean, you're talking about people who are not on the sunlit side of 50 for the most part. But there is, unfortunately, a large and fairly formidable club these people wield. They punch well above their weight, to alter the metaphor, when you talk about electoral politics. People in that demographic cohort vote, and they mobilize people to vote, whether you're talking about defending Social Security or supporting the warfare state. And that's one of the reasons why I think that what this person has said and written, and he doesn't have a whole lot of influence beyond that demographic, but within that demographic he's a heavyweight. And it's because the fact that he can leverage that influence within the Fox News constituency and voting bloc that I think that's worthy of our attention, especially given that he's not exactly an outlier. We have people like retired Lieutenant Colonel James Zumwalt, who's a Marine who was involved in Vietnam and the invasion of Panama and the first Gulf War. And he's somebody who's constantly on television or writing for journals that deal with public and military policy. When he uses the expression final solution non-ironically and talks about the need to hasten the extinction of Muslims, not merely Muslim terrorist groups, and he gives us the entire litany of all these terrorist groups, including people like al-Shabaab, who are not a threat to the United States by any definition. As far as I can tell, this is a revolutionary response to American imperialism in Africa that doesn't pose any threat to the homeland, as now we're prompted to refer to it. But not merely terrorist groups, but also Muslims who are victimized by terrorist groups because they're possessed of what he considers to be the same death wish. And so it's a form of severe mercy from the perspective of Lieutenant Colonel Zumwalt to kill people indiscriminately, because in that way we're granting the fondest wish not only of the suicide bombers who crave martyrdom and the jihadists who are likewise motivated, but also their victims who aspire to the same afterlife, and so presumably would be doing the world a favor and doing them an individualized favor by consummating their religious aspirations. This is the mindset of people who are discussing these things openly in the United States of America in the year of our Lord 2014, many of whom profess to be Christians, and some of whom have very large audiences. And this is happening, of course, amid the threat, the perceived and much overhyped threat of ISIS, and in conjunction with events like the murder in Moore, Oklahoma, that had no colorable connection at all whatsoever to Islamic theology, but yet is being treated as if it were the opening salvo in a domestic jihad by the fifth columnist among us.
All right, we'll be right back with Will Grigg after this, y'all. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm talking with Will Grigg from the blog Pro Libertate, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. His book is Liberty in Eclipse. And, boy, you know, Anthony Gregory pointed out that Bush had really kept the lid on anti-Muslim bigotry in America by insisting that this is not a war against Islam. These are just some kooks who've perverted the name of Islam in order to justify attacking us, and so we're going to show them. But your Muslim neighbors are your friends and neighbors, and so don't get them confused. But boy, once he was gone, just it was like taking the lid off the pot and the damn thing just boiled over, where now, you know, what is delusional is no longer marginal. And as you know, I was going to ask you, but you answered it. You know, just how much influence do these people have on the right? I mean, I don't keep track of my different TV preachers and how big their audiences are and this kind of thing. I just, it's a specialty I don't have. But, I mean, what you're saying is this guy's listened to by the same group of people that listen to O'Reilly and Hannity, and that's not marginal. I mean, that's pretty conventional Republican politics. So, well, let me ask you this then. What's the Republican Party say about these guys? Anything at all? Do they disavow any of this stuff? I mean, when people are talking about a final solution, killing a billion plus, maybe a billion and a quarter people in the world till there's nobody left that believes in Muhammad, are they just talking about killing Arabs, or they don't distinguish, or what?
It's a little bit unclear as to what these people aspire to do, because obviously there's not going to be a all-encompassing, fully orbed war of extermination globally where you'd actually have any realistic prospect of killing 1 billion people and just targeting that cohort. If you have that type of a global conflict, then of course you're going to have a great deal of so-called collateral damage, and that's a prospect that I think that even these people might flinch from. But I do think that what they're talking about is imposing domestically a set of strictures that would make life very, very miserable for perfectly innocent people of the Muslim faith. How much influence do they have in the Republican Party? What does the Republican Party say about these people? As little as possible. In terms of the influence, I mentioned that Gary Cass had been involved with D. James Kennedy, actually had alluded to that, and the Coral Ridge Ministries, and that's a pretty prominent ministry here nationally in terms of its influence on social policy. In localized Republican precincts, I'm thinking now specifically of Oklahoma, you have people like John Bennett, who's a state representative, who's the chair of the counterterrorism caucus in that state. That's not an inconsequential Republican or conservative state, particularly in the realm of social conservatism. This is the fellow who has, for the last several months, been descending upon Tea Party groups and telling people that their Muslim neighbors are part of an internal cancer that must be cut out, and telling them in so many words that no matter how benign these people appear, that they're seething with unexpressed and unconsummated desires to kill every infidel within their field of vision. And so after the killing at the Von Foods plant in Moore that was carried out by somebody who had spent maybe a couple of months attending a mosque in Oklahoma City and whose religious views are deliriously eclectic, this is a guy who would combine Arab expressions of greeting with Hebrew expressions of greeting, who apparently had been rolling around in this yeasty ferment that included the black Hebrew Israelites, and whose Facebook page included quotes, as far as I can tell, from the Satanic Bible. He's a thoroughly confused guy, violent ex-con, paroled ex-con, who, according to the imam of this mosque, the Greater Islamic Society of Oklahoma City, was somebody who had distinguished himself by expressing vehement dislike for white Americans. This guy is about as representative of Islam as Jeffrey Dahmer would be representative of WASPs, as far as I can tell. And the killing that took place at the Von Foods plant had as much to do with Islam as the Nicole Brown Simpson murder had to do with somebody having a background in, I think, Southern Baptist Protestant Christianity, which I think was O.J. Simpson's background, assuming, of course, that he was the murderer rather than the others unknown. But you have a literal incident of workplace violence that occurred just a couple of hours after he had been fired, or I think suspended from his job, because of his irrepressible hatred for white people. He comes back armed with a knife and attacks somebody he held responsible for that discomfiture. And that had nothing to do with the reported fact that he had been propagating on behalf of the Islamic religion, to which he had just recently become an adherent, and he may have been possessed with the zeal of the recent convert. But within the mosque, he was certainly an outlier. He wasn't well-liked.
Well, and even if there was a little bit of copycat from watching CNN, that still doesn't have a thing. I mean, that you'd have to take another leap and say ISIS is representative of Islam in the sense of the way that they do their beheadings, too, which is also a bunch of crap on its face. So,
sure. I mean, you've got in ISIS something that more resembles the Khmer Rouge than anything else. But this John Bennett guy, this
Yes, back to the Republicans, because let me just add this real quick as part of the setup. In 2007, Giuliani had a fundraiser who was, I think, a pretty powerful guy at the state level somewhere, who was caught on camera saying, well, we got to prevent the rise of the Muslim. And that was all he said, which was stupid and collectivist and retarded. And nobody, but he didn't say by killing them all and their babies, because they like being victims anyway, so it's okay. I mean, he's not going around saying every Muslim in your neighborhood is out to get you. His implication was still over there, the Islamo-fascist caliphate we're bombing or whatever, or over in Iraq. Not all Muslim neighbors in American cities should be considered a fifth column, which is what you've got this Republican office holder saying and getting away with it.
Yeah, saying it repeatedly and defiantly and impenitently, doing so on camera, doing so in radio and television interviews, saying explicitly that all Muslims are just as bad as ISIS, and doing so as the chair of the counterterrorism caucus in a fairly significant state, Republican-dominated state government. And not in any way being reined in or rebuked or corrected by the Republican leadership in that state. It's interesting that one of the people I didn't have a chance to interview for this piece is an ordained Baptist minister who actually visited Iran during the hostage crisis to try to free our people and had a personal audience with the Ayatollah Khomeini. He's got a Ph.D. in a couple of fields having to do with comparative religion. And unlike John Mennett, this fellow has actually read the Quran and the Hadith. He's actually spent time in the company of Muslims to find out what they think and what their theological viewpoints would be. He's challenged Bennett to a public debate because Bennett claims that he's read the Quran and the Hadiths and all these other things. To judge from his level of diction and his fluency with the English language, I don't think he's read anything more intellectually challenging than a Bazooka Joe comic strip. But, of course, Bennett has sought counsel of prudence in avoiding a public discussion with somebody who's actually a credentialed Christian theologian to discuss the supposed the debatable merits of Islam or the supposed latent violence inherent in that religion. But he's, of course, descending on every Tea Party gathering he can find to pontificate about his supposed expertise on Islam. And as far as I can tell, his acquaintance with Islam comes from the fact that he was sent as a Marine to Iraq and Afghanistan to kill Muslims. As far as I can tell, that's the only credential he has as an expert on Islam, is that he's actually been involved in murdering Muslims in countries halfway around the world. But the thing that I find most disturbing about all this is that this does resonate with certain people in Oklahoma. Witness the fact that when people at this mosque were assembling signs and other protest paraphernalia for a public demonstration against ISIS, they were getting phone calls from local Oklahoma residents who were threatening to kill them, including by beheading. This was before the Von Foods massacre, the Von Foods murder, attempted massacre, I should clarify. This happened weeks before that incident, and of course, since that's happened, they've been getting the same kind of messages. And last January, this is an anecdote I share in the article that I thought was just illustrative of the delirious nonsense that's being spouted, the effect that it has on people who are not terribly tightly wrapped. There was an incident in which a young woman wearing a headscarf was accosted by a large and apparently drunken lout who referred to her as, among other things, a Muslim bitch, threatened her with a knife, slashed her tires, and hit her in the face. Turns out that this woman was a Christian refugee from Lebanon who just happened to affect a type of headdress that, to this person's uncluttered mind, signified that she must obviously be a Muslim.
Yeah, same difference.
Exactly. And the thing is, if you embrace the Gary Cass worldview, then she, being presumably part of the offspring of Ishmael, really should expect that kind of treatment because she's genetically predisposed to be our enemy, whether or not she professes to be a Christian. And that leads us to another question here. Let's assume that these people come to power, or at least obtain enough influence, that they're able to put in place some version of what they're talking about, and you'd see them present a convert or leave or die ultimatum of the sort that ISIS has been delivering within their area of claimed jurisdiction, interestingly enough. Let's assume that some Muslims do make a profession of faith. On the basis of what these people are saying, they'd have to say that this is taqiyya. This is simply them lying for strategic purposes, right, and they'd be put to death or expelled anyway.
Right. All right, now, wait, you have two choices. I can either just keep recording you through the break here for a few minutes, or you can hold on for 6 minutes and give me one more segment. What do you think?
Let's keep recording through the break.
Okay.
Right.
All right, we'll be right back, y'all. All right, so now let me ask you this, because this is important, and I don't want to leave it out of the discussion here. What does Muhammad say about how the rest of us in the world who aren't Muslims should be treated by people who are Muslims anyway.
What kind of expert
are you?
I'm not an expert on Islam. I've read a great deal of the Quran, and I've spent a lot of time in the company of people who have read the Quran and know it authoritatively. My exposure to the so-called war surahs leaves me with the impression that you're dealing with passages in their holy book that read in some sense quite a bit like the book of Joshua in the Old Testament or some parts of 1 Samuel, where you're talking about a time of war between antagonists who seem to be incapable of coexisting. And in the context of that set of circumstances, there were some admonitions given that would be considered, I think, an exhortation toward total war, but only within those circumstances. They do not necessarily translate into general application when you're not in a time of war with an enemy who's apparently implacable. And in reading the war surahs that are constantly being invoked by these people I call professional mosque baiters, it seems to me that there are always qualifications here that make them apply in situations where they're fighting what they consider to be a defensive war. They're not talking about conquest. They're talking about self-protection and then ruthlessly dealing with people who have been ruthless toward them. That's how these surahs, in any case, are interpreted by people I've spoken with who consider them to be authoritative, such as Imam Inchasi, who's the head of the mosque there in Oklahoma City. And I've listened to a great many of his sermons, and they're all available online. You can go and download them and listen to them, probably 5 or 6 years worth of sermons. They're about an hour long, and a lot of them are delivered in mixed Arabic and English, which makes it somewhat challenging as a casual listener. But there is a constant thread woven through these sermons of forbearance in the face of persecution and of proportionality and of seeking objective, mutually beneficial justice where there are disputes. And he is expansively complimentary toward the Christian faith and toward Jesus as a personality because, like most faithful Muslims, he regards Jesus to be a prophet, not a Messiah, but as a prophet. And he is predisposed toward a sense of amity with people he calls the people of the book, meaning Jews and Christians, you know, fellow monotheists. And all of this, Scott, is even more remarkable because this is a guy who's a Palestinian. He's a Palestinian Arab who was born in Lebanon, whose family was numbered among those who have been expropriated and treated as second-class citizens and otherwise persecuted and harassed. He's somebody who came to the United States as a young man and got involved in entrepreneurial capitalism before he found his religious vocation. And the way that he approaches his calling as an imam, as a cleric, is to preach to the faithful the need for defining their religious obligations in a way that recognizes the common humanity of people who are not part of their faith group. It's the sort of thing where he's doing every single thing that the war party says that the Muslims never do. He's always condemned terrorism. For 25 years of his life, he's condemned terrorism. He was in Oklahoma during the Oklahoma City bombing when, of course, we were told the Muslims had to be responsible for this. He lived through that. He lived through, the horrors of 2001. He's been dealing now with the aftermath of the Gulf War, the war in Afghanistan, and the war in Libya, and ISIS, and all of this. He's been preaching the same message consistently, which is, we have nothing to do with this. We have nothing to do with aggressive violence. If we see people among us who are trying to incite us toward violence of that kind, please let me know about it so I can rebuke and correct him. And if he's somebody who's inclined toward criminal activities, call the police, for heaven's sake, because we want to have nothing to do with this. And he gets no credit for it. He gets no credit for the fact that he and his congregation have been involved in outreach on every front, including humanitarian outreach. They were on the ground there and more after the tornado a year ago.
Well, like you say, oh, no, that's just all part of their PR stunt where Muhammad says it's okay to lie to trick the infidels into whatever. But now, and I'm going to have to let you go real quick, but I need you to answer about this, too. But so Muslims in America, obviously, is the focus here, but there's also the context is the entire terror war and the narrative of the other billion Muslims in the world who are all, never mind no man's land between Iraq and Syria, it's all one big Islamo-fascist caliphate coming to get us, Will. And I wonder whether you can really challenge the idea that this clash of civilizations, one way or the other, and maybe led by horrible bin Ladenite propagandists and neocon propagandists on either side, But still, that it's the whole thing is just sort of, you know, destined to take place. Like, what else are you going to do? These two civilizations, there's just not enough room for the both of them around here.
I don't think that's the case, because where it's achieved stability, where the Islamic culture has found roots and managed to sustain itself, they've modernized, which means that they are no longer being governed by 7th or 8th century or 11th or 12th century presuppositions about the irrepressible violence that will result when you have Muslims and non-Muslims trying to occupy the same tract of land. You can actually take a look at some phases of Ottoman history where there was a great deal of respect and protection in the 19th century in particular, but, you know, before nationalism became such a plague upon the face of the earth and upon humanity in general, there was a growing understanding in Ottoman Turkey of the need to protect individual rights and protect property and to recognize the limits on what government can do. But the problem is that the United States has been abetting and propagating exactly the worst form of this with our alliance with the Saudis. I mean, the Saudis really are implicated in promoting most of this stuff, either by way of paying the Danegeld to groups that want to depose them or using their influence to prop up terrorist groups they can deploy against Iran or others. And I think that the best way to approach this is to understand that we're going to have disagreements. There's going to be confusion. There's going to be tension. But it's something that's manageable. It doesn't need to become apocalyptic unless we insist that it has to be. And these people are craving an apocalypse. Now, the people I wrote about in this essay are the sort of people who eagerly look upon the prospect of eschatological violence as a way of bringing about the triumph of righteousness. And right. They're the mirror image of some of the worst elements that you find in Islam.
Yeah, in other words, it's no accident that all the people... It's no accident all the people who believe in this clash happen to be a bunch of raving lunatics whose arguments make
no
sense.
Yeah.
Right. All right, listen, I've kept you way over, and I got to go, but thanks so much, Will. I really appreciate it.
You take care, Scott. I'll
have a great weekend. That's the great Will Grigg, everybody. Freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Pro Libertate. And yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I stepped all over his damn punchline there. His darn punchline. Adam, fix that for me, would you? Thanks. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism in the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. The great Will Grigg. So what I asked him during the break there was, I asked him about, well, what does Muhammad say should happen to all of us non-Mohammedans? And then I also asked him, well, so what about the whole culture war and clash of civilizations and whatever and how unnecessary is it all? And we didn't really have time to develop about how. No, that is PR for the arms manufacturers and the Israeli lobby and the government. And as Justin Raimondo writes at antiwar.com today, the do-gooder liberals who just want to change the world, make it a better place, and what better way to do that than with American military force, the most irresistible force. It's a giant coalition of no goodness, if you ask me. Anyway, the great Will Grigg, you gotta read this thing, man. Crush the Seed of Ishmael, a final solution to the Muslim problem. And the thing is, you know, this is part of what's going on here is it's 13 years of this now. And so, it's just a lot of space to be taken up with a lot of crap. So. And you know, I don't know. I need to learn how to write again, man. I'm too writer's blocky and impatient. I hate editing my own stuff, going back over it. It's just maddening. My brain don't work that way. But I want to kind of write about how everybody's right a little bit and everybody's wrong a little bit about the whole Islamic radical thing. I don't know if I can say it well enough to actually get it right, but Michael Scheuer comes on this show and says that, hey, man, this absolutely is part and parcel of Islam, and anyone who says it's not is lying to you. Anyone who says that bin Laden, and for that matter, Baghdadi, and these guys represent some absolutely fringe belief in Islam, you're crazy. But what's the question? The question is, what belief is that that we're talking about here? And that belief is that they have the right to use defensive violence. Now, in the case of the bin Ladenites, of course, they target innocent civilians, which there is not consensus for those tactics whatsoever, for suicide bombing or anything like that. But does Islam sanctify or even mandate the use of defensive force? I don't know the exact quotes and what have you, but yeah, that's in there. What's not in there is invading and conquering the world and, you know, cutting everybody's head off if they don't convert and whatever. Of course, probably Baghdadi and his few closest friends believe that kind of crap. But other than that, Muslims don't believe in that. But so sometimes I get frustrated with Michael Scheuer because he's not clear in his language. You could kind of take it either way, that he sort of is saying, yeah, Islam says they have to do this to us. But sometimes then he leaves off the why, though. He doesn't go back to, because George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Barack Obama have killed more than a couple of million Arab Muslims, especially, in the last 25 years. And that's a real problematic problem, and it's helped destabilize the entire region, and it's helped generate a lot of people who hate us and want to kill us. And yes, that includes all of Congress and all of their blank checks for the state of Israel, not their existence, for their permanent criminal. I don't mean illegal by some baby blue UN mandate. I just mean criminal under the natural law of, you know, property. Read your Rothbard. Their criminal occupations of southern Lebanon and of Palestine for all this time. And so, yes, it's true that the most right-wing radical of the Sunni fringe, which would be the bin Ladenites, the Takfiris of the Salafists, of the Wahhabis, or whatever the hell, the tenth of a percent, of course, they're the ones, the most religiously motivated, are going to have a cutting edge on volunteering to go and fight a far enemy. You're not going to find that many people that committed to do that most of the time. But then again, you have people who are from occupied territory. They don't need a religious motivation at all, just a simple nationalist one. The only reason the religion really comes into play is because it makes for good PR by those who send people on suicide attacks, that it's some kind of martyrdom or whatever. So they sort of, you know, dress it up that way. And also the fact that in times of desperation and violence and grief unending, people turn toward the last thing they got, their faith, when the Americans have come and killed their whole family. That's, you could read the Coburns, Andrew and Patrick Coburn, writing about Iraq in, back in the 1990s, about how the sanctions are driving these people into a much more religious and fundamentalist outlook on everything, because it's all they got left. It's part of the sectarian war. The Iraqi community, that's a pretty big definition for people who are not from the same sect. Then again, they'd been in Iraq for 100 years, so that ain't nothing. And they did have an Iraqi identity. But you come and smash it and blow up their whole everything, every single institution they got, and round up all their sons in the middle of the night and whatever, whatever. Well, people don't know what's Iraq and what's not anymore, what institutions represent their whole society or not anymore. So they turn to closer and closer identifications of community, their own neighborhood, their own family only. And then, you know, once they get killed again, then all they got left is their faith. In that desperation, it comes into play. But back to Michael Scheuer to finish the point. Islamic so-called extremism plays a role in motivating the cutting edge of what he says is you shouldn't even call terrorism. He says you should call it the global Islamist insurgency. And you see why they hate that term, because insurgency implies, in its very, in the very word itself, that there is a dominant power that they're rising up against. Insurgency doesn't mean offensive strike by an Islamo-fascist caliphate. Insurgency means volunteer rebels fighting against what they perceive as illegitimate power. Who could they be thinking of? The American Empire that supports every one of their dictators, and then when they get tired of that, every one of their revolutions too. Blow everything up. Ruin everything for everyone. Run all the religious minorities out of town. Kill a million people here and a million people there. Bill Clinton, Bush Jr. And Obama has not killed millions, but he's killed certainly hundreds of thousands. Certainly, you know, very high tens of thousands. Must be hundreds of thousands. And hey, if you count all the Somalis who starved to death under Mao Tse-Obama's reign there with his sock puppet Ethiopian army destroying the place during the famine of 2011, especially 2010-11, then, yeah, he's up in the bronze position behind Junior and Clinton there by not too far. But anyway, so, you know, I am an atheist myself. I don't believe in that God stuff for a moment. I mean, come on. You kidding me? It's just superstition, just like everything. But I'm not trying to beat you over the head about it. I'm just describing my own point of view on the subject. And so, in a sense, I agree with Bill Maher and all them that, you know, especially you look at countries like Clive was talking about on the show yesterday, where people are getting the death penalty for blasphemy in Pakistan. Where this is just out of control, man. People have the right to believe whatever they want. How back-asswards are these societies that people don't have the right to their own conscience without being hauled before the state and prosecuted? Especially when it's just somebody's interpretation of what you may have said that may have implied some sort of disrespect. I mean, for crying out loud, you know? I would like to see... I think it's Sheldon Richmond. I'm paraphrasing Sheldon Richmond here. He said, you know, Christianity and Judaism, they've had their reform movements. They have entered the modern age. And that's somewhat true with Islam in some places. But at the same time, we could use a big one of those. But of course, again, back to Michael Scheuer, as he's been saying all this time, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, American foreign policy is Bin Laden's indispensable ally in radicalizing the region and turning them toward his view, making this problem where it did not exist before. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Come here, you microphone. You're sinking on me a little bit here. All right. So, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, you know, I don't know. I should mostly keep my trap shut about, you know, big picture intelligence stuff that you need intelligence to really get into. But I can imagine pretty easily an alternative world where Ron Paul won in 88 and the Soviet Union dissolved on his watch instead of George Bush Sr.'s. And then so instead of declaring total unimpeded world empire, the empire was abolished. And then after doing a nice couple of terms, then Harry Brown would have been elected in 1996. And then he would have been there to build the bridge to the 21st century, as Bill Clinton always called it. And then we would have started the 21st century without a terror war, without a world empire. Just think of, just for a moment, Eric Garris was saying this to me yesterday. Think for a moment how wealthy this country could be if it wasn't for all this war. And of course, what goes along that is the boom and the bust cycle that's generated by the government's money printing machine, basically. Their fancy bookkeeping trick for creating trillions of dollars in new credit, which leads to the giant booms that lead to the giant busts and the terrible dislocations in our economy that throw so many people out of work and into poverty and destroy families and destroy businesses and destroy lives. It's all tied up in the warfare state, of course. Just think. And you know what? I've said this before, but what the hell? It's a radio show, and that means a lot of you guys have never heard stuff going back years. I don't know. It's been a while since I talked about this. And in fact, now that I've seen it in reruns a couple of times, at least maybe it's more likely that you'll know what I'm talking about. Did you ever see the episode of The Family Guy where it's like sliders and they're going into all the different dimensions? And so one of the dogs are the masters and the people are the pets. And yeah, right. It's The Family Guy. But in one of them, they go to beautiful, pristine, and very futuristic, super modern Jetsons land type of a place. Not exactly Jetsons, but it's very futuristic and awesome. And then so Stewie has Ziggy explain that, oh, in this version, Christianity never existed. And so in Seth MacFarlane talk, Western civilization saved all of the, you know, had all that opportunity cost, was able to go into capital investment into building a better life for everyone kind of thing. And I thought, oh, what a wasted joke. Because the joke would be perfect if he had just said, yeah, in this dimension, Wilson never got us into World War I. So there never were Soviets or Nazis anywhere in the world. There was no World War II. World War I ended as a stalemate. And after that, Germany and Britain got along and things were all right. But instead, no, it was the 20th century of totalitarianism and death and the 60 or 70 million people killed in World War II. And then really 60 or 70 million people killed somewhere in there. People start losing track in the tens of millions when tens of millions become remainders. And then of course the whole Cold War and the evil American Empire and all its lying, butchery, murder. And instead, basically everybody's rich because there's so much goddamn capital investment going on around here that, to be poor is no problem. You know, everybody's got their own R2-D2 to take care of stuff. It's perfect. All you would need to do would be go back in time and suicide bomb Woodrow Wilson. Oh, I shouldn't say that. That's like going to provoke some weird misinterpretation. Just go back in time and somehow successfully campaign for, well, let's see, who? Taft? TR? That's a real problematic problem, isn't it? I guess Taft out of the three would have been the least likely to get us into World War I at that point. Because we know what Wilson did, and we know that TR called him a wimp every day. TR was McCain to Wilson's Barack Obama back then, you know? So, it's not like you had a bunch of good guys to choose from. Taft was just TR's handpicked guy, his vice president, in the first place. In fact, probably the only reason, they say he just hated Taft and wanted to unseat him and replace him and whatever, because he was a total kook, that TR. I could see that, maybe. But it also, doesn't it make more sense that he really just wanted to split the Republican vote and make sure that Wilson won since he was Morgan's guy? And they had their plans for their bank and their war. I mean, what do I know? I wasn't there. Yeah. Anyway, opportunity costs. Think about how much America wastes on this unending warfare. And, you know, I think it's right for Will Grigg to compare ISIS to the Khmer Rouge, which means they're just as brutal and sadistic and murderous as the Nazis. But you see, it implies also that they're a bunch of bark-eating lunatics from the backwoods of nowhere who know nothing and have no power to do anything other than to the poor innocent civilian victims within their immediate proximity. And yes, I'm plagiarizing Spalding Gray there. If you've ever seen Swimming to Cambodia, yeah, well, I ought to watch that. The bark-eating crazies there. ISIS, yeah, Baghdadi. He's just like Hitler, only without the Reich. He's got the worst part of Iraq. Come on. I told you, I keep saying this because it's important. The scaremonger from Rand wrote, oh my God, these guys might make as much as $2 billion a day, which, admittedly does make them the richest terrorist group in the world, but it makes them the most pathetic, tiny, little landlocked state surrounded by enemies with hardly any resources, and they can only sell oil on the black market. So if America could only get their number one most bestest allies, aside from Israel and Britain, of course, the Turks, to do the right thing at all, then that cuts off their entire, all they gotta do is seal that border up with cops. I mean, not that they can completely ban the black market in oil, but you understand, they could certainly clamp down and haven't. $2 billion a year is not quite an Islamo-fascist caliphate. It's more like a Khmer Rouge campground. All right. Hey, the number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. You can call up and panic about Ebola. You can ask me questions or criticize me or bring up topics, talk about the wars. There's Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. Libya, of course, is still a horrible crisis. Nigeria, if you want to talk about that. And then, of course, Iraq and Syria. The next big Mesopotamia. By the way, next week, they promised Anand Gopal on Afghanistan, Dar Jamil on Iraq, Max Blumenthal on the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip from July and August. So stay tuned to the show. And we'll be right back after this, too. 512-271-4836. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, how's it going, y'all? It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton, and that's why I named it that, and blah, blah, blah. ScottHorton.org. I interviewed the same five people 3,500 times. You can find them all in the archives there. No, that's not true. There's more different people than that. 3,500 of them there. In the archives under scotthorton.org/interviews and a bunch of other stuff there, scotthorton.org. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. All right, cool. Now, let's do some calls this Friday, and that seems to be like a radio tradition sort of a thing. We got one on the line hanging on. You guys can participate too if you want. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And I guess, you know, I don't know, I should come up with a question of the day or whatever. I know. How about me and Gareth, the great Gareth Porter, we got a $10 bet. I say they're sending in the Marines by New Year's. And he says, no way, so you guys can. And I don't want to hear just cynicism. I want to hear real arguments. See what you guys think about that. Or say whatever you want. I don't care. Ask whatever you want. Talk about whatever you want. I'm Scott. This is my show. Welcome to it. It's you.
Hey, Scott. This is Dennis. How are you?
Hey, how are you doing, man?
All right. The great show and, of course, a tremendous interview with the always outstanding Will Grigg.
Isn't he something?
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, he's been my favorite since the 1990s. I used to read him in the New American all the time when I was in high school.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, the two of you being definitely beacons of courage, integrity, and liberty. And,
Anyway, get to the point.
Okay. But here's... get to the point here. Here's a question for you.
Okay.
I've got a question for you about your wager with Gareth Porter.
Mm-hmm.
Where? Sending the Marines in where? There are so many places where they could try to send the Marines in.
Oh, yeah, I should be more specific. Wait, let me answer that one first. I mean Mosul. That's what I'm thinking. Mosul and or Fallujah, but I think Mosul would be first. To dislodge, because that's where Baghdadi got up on the balcony and said, meet your new caliph, and all of that kind of crap. So that's, I think, for that reason, I think that'll be the prime target. And I think that they won't be able to withstand the political pressure not to do it, because to bomb from the air means to leave Baghdadi in power indefinitely. And they just can't do that. He's going to do another PR stunt, and then what are they going to do, you know?
You know, right, and then how quickly from there till they get to Syria, the Marines, that is.
Well, yeah, that one's more complicated, man. I don't know. They have got such a mess, Dennis, in the Syria policy here. I mean, it seems so far that really de facto they're turning back to Assad, but they can't really turn back to him. They can leave him alone. So far, they're leaving him alone and attacking his enemies only. But then again, Turkey is still insisting that, we want a no-fly zone and a safe haven, presumably for, just the FSA moderate guys to continue fighting Assad. Only under protection of American and or NATO Turkish air power there in northern Syria. So Erdogan is doubling down on his anti-Assad thing right now, just at the time that Obama, if he's sane at all, has got to be realizing. I mean, obviously he's not going to do nothing. So the idea that he's really just going to rely on this force of 5,000 moderates protected by American air power to fight Nusra, ISIS, and Assad and Hezbollah on the other side all at the same time, starting in 6 months from now or whatever. I mean, what madness is this? No one believes that for a minute. No one even believes that that's actually the policy. And we all know that the Israelis and the Gulf states, and like I was just saying, Erdogan in Turkey, and all the neocons here at home, they want rid of Assad, and they don't care if it helps al-Qaeda. They'll say it over and over again. Michael Oren isn't just speaking for himself. He's speaking for, read David Frum. David Frum came out, and everyone said, oh my God, did David Frum write something anti-war? Yeah, because what it said was, no, don't attack ISIS, because they're a thorn in the side of Iran and Assad, and I hate them more. Yeah, but ISIS are the sons of Osama, man. But they don't care about that. They only care about Israel.
Okay, you need a scorecard to tell all the players, because they put them over. They were for them before they were against them.
This is absolutely all crazy.
The flopping in that.
You know what it is? Here's the thing about it. I know I sound like some kind of stupid birther or whatever when I say it's high treason. But I don't mean that it, you know, really David Frum or Obama or any of these guys are actually loyal to the caliphate or the bin Ladenites or whatever. It's just that they think that these guys are perfectly useful to keep around and use in certain circumstances. And to think, I mean, you would have to be Israeli or Turkish or Saudi and not an American to think that Assad is our enemy more than al-Qaeda is our enemy. For Christ's sake, even Obama himself bombed them the other day. He had to make up a new name for the al-Nusra Front, which we all know al-Nusra is al-Qaeda in Syria. So he said, well, it was the Khorasan group I bombed, when it was his claim that they were plotting an attack on the United States. These are the guys we've been supporting the whole time, and still we're pretending, the government is pretending that Assad is the enemy in Syria more than them. And Assad is a brutal butcher, but in a war that America has held back the other side of all along. So it's as much the West's fault as his. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah,
that's what you get when you call this show. I yell and scream at you.
Well, no, that's part of the charm of it. This is unique stuff. You can't get this everywhere, Scott.
Yeah, well.
And besides, you know, again, Assad, you know, being the Ba'athist, like Hussein was, I mean, that was they were secular, right. not theocratic.
Yeah, so murderous. Murderous in the extreme, but not theocratic. And that's an extremely important point. In fact, I don't know if you heard this one, but I need to say it again right now so that I'll remember to, you know, use this as a point repeatedly in the future, because I think it's a good one. Everyone now looks at the de-Ba'athification of Iraq. They don't want to say it was wrong to kill Saddam and his sons and overthrow the government, but they say, oh, but you really should not have de-Ba'athified the government and abolished the army. Well, can you imagine if in 2003 Saddam Hussein was already up to his eyeballs in a bin Ladenite insurgency in Sunnistan against the Ba'ath Party, al-Qaeda in Iraq, if it had already existed before the war and Saddam had been fighting them and America had then come in and overthrew him and overthrew the Bothas and de-Bothified and abolished the army? What madness would that have been? If it was already going on, it didn't just lead to it. But if it had already been going on and then they contributed to it that much by firing every Sunni with a rifle and giving him no job except fighting occupation and joining up with the bin Ladenites. And yet that's exactly what we're doing in Syria right now. Assad is a Bothist, he's up to his eyeballs in jihadists, and America is trying to de-Bothify the government and abolish the army. Well, what the hell is going to happen after that, then, if we're right in the middle of the worst-case scenario? What's going to happen to the Shia and the Christians and the Alawites and the rest of the Druze and the rest of the minority that supports the Assad dictatorship after that? Here we are doing the same radio show, Dennis, in 2016, saying, yeah, that al-Nusra genocide against the Druze and whatever that served as the justification for the full-scale invasion of Syria, saw that coming, right? I mean, what are they doing? It's mad. I mean, well, that's what they're doing. It's sick.
It's the George Costanza foreign policy. Was that long? If I had known, or like doing the opposite of what they think they should do.
All right. You have one more.
It's all those things. Just one last quick thing. I think some people that would be like-minded think the Ebola thing is a really that is a really serious problem. But of course, we all know, and including the folks that think it's a serious problem, is that it's going to be used, we know what for, essentially the police state and the surveillance state and all that other stuff.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know what, I'm going to say a thing or two about that on the other side of this break.
Ebola, all right, thanks, buddy. Bye-bye.
Hey, Dennis, it's great to hear from you, man. Take it easy. Thanks for calling in. We'll be right back, y'all. Oh, yeah, and Skunk, I'm going to answer your question in the chat room, too, in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. The phone number, if you want to call in, it's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Want to talk about some things? So, yeah. The Ebola thing, I'm just not going to worry about it until I see a better reason to worry about it. I do think it's problematic that government is basically the only institution we have in charge of the public health in times of emergencies. The public health, I don't know, language. Nobody wants Ebola spreading around. But hiring the cops to beat it back, I don't know, man. I did see, and I know this isn't perfect for all situations everywhere or whatever, but I think someone in the chat room sent me a link yesterday or 2 days ago from NPR News, where they covered a Firestone company town in Liberia, where they have the resources, obviously, they have the capital investment, and apparently headquarters back in Ohio said, spend the money, do what it takes, win, go ahead, blank check, work, go, and they did it, and they have completely and successfully contained any outbreak of Ebola in their entire town. There's been one or two cases or whatever, and they just locked it down. And they did it in a way that governments over there have been completely unable to do. And so anyway, need flexibility. That's the real key. And bureaucracies don't really provide for much flexibility in crises most of the time. But then again, I don't really have reason. I mean, look at the guy in Dallas that had, nobody's gotten it from him, right? Nobody. They had a cop go, oh, I don't feel good, guys. And then, yeah, false alarm, dude. Quit your sniveling. So the guy in Dallas that died apparently didn't infect anyone else. So I'm not going to worry that much about that. And as far as the boiling cauldron and deliberately destroying the Middle East and all that, I got a bunch of stuff to say about that. It's a very good question raised by a skunk in the chat room and raised by all kinds of people all the time, including me. But right now I got a call And maybe this call is about that, maybe not, I don't know. But first we'll do the call, and then we'll do the chat room questionnaire about the, well, let me go ahead and write it down so I don't forget, because I'll do things like that. All right. And then click that. Hey, I'm Scott. You're on the air. How's it going?
Hey, what's going on, Scott? How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Hey, good.
Oh, no, your phone's completely breaking up on me. What now? Oh, man. Hey, sorry, you got the worst phone in the world. I'll tell you what, I got you on mute now, but I'll give it a few seconds, you know, kill some time for a moment here, and then see if maybe you can get some better reception, and then I'll hit the button again, and we'll see whether you got a little better reception. Nope, he's gone. He's gone. Worst cell phone in North America right there. Sorry. Anyone else wants to call in? 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And that goes for you, too, if you want to try calling back from a different phone or a better place. 512-271-4836. Anyway, yeah, so the boiling cauldron thing. Yes, it is true that Bernard Goldberg and before him, Oded Yanan, and after him, well, anyway, those two guys and Michael Ledeen, they have... you know, and others, I guess, have supported the idea that what the Middle East really needs is to just be smashed. It's a very revolutionary doctrine that says everything right now completely sucks, so let's just go ahead and smash it. And now, in the case of the Yanan plan, I think they meant for just, you know, complete chaos forever. A lot of times... coping with crumbling states and a clean break, a new strategy for securing the realm by David Wurmser get lumped in there. And for that matter, rebuilding America's defenses get lumped in there as saying, you know, the plan is to just smash these states into pieces and that kind of thing. Because, you know, weak tribal forces fighting each other all day are no threat to Israel. That's the theory. Well, and I guess they're no threat to oil companies, that kind of thing. But on the other hand, if you actually look at the record of what they've done and who did it and what they're trying to do and you really parse it, I don't think Michael Ledeen is really calling most of these shots. I mean, it's true it was a very Ariel Sharonian agenda to invade Iraq at all. Don't get me wrong. But then again, things didn't necessarily have to turn out the way they turned out. Not that I'm supporting it in any measure, but I'm just saying there's still a hell of a lot of variables played out from 03 on. And Iraq is sure split in three now, and there's a lot of chaos around. But even if you read Coping with Crumbling States, the whole point of expediting the chaotic collapse, as David Wurmser put it, was to put together a stable and agreeable future, not just warring tribes of madmen forever blowing themselves up and whatever kind of thing. That's, I don't think, really in there. And, you know, during the break, I was actually Googling around Tom Englehart and, quote, they thought, because he's written this up so many times. I was trying to find the best, you know, intro that Tom Englehart has ever written to somebody else's article here, where he talks about what the Bush crew, meaning the neocons and Dick Cheney and them, the real architects of the war, what they thought they were going to get by invading Iraq. And it ain't what they got. What they thought was it would be a cakewalk and that they would have 56 bases and the Iraqi people may as well have been figments of somebody else's imagination or whatever. They didn't imagine that every single Iraqi combined amounted to more than a fly compared to the might of the U.S. Army or whatever. They weren't worried about all that. They were just going to have their way. And, of course, Chalabi had assured Paul Wolfowitz that all the most secular and modernist Shiites would win the elections because Iraqis are just like that. And then they would pressure the Iranian people to overthrow their government just by example, by showing what a great democracy Iraq is now. and how it wouldn't be a sectarian fight, everything would be wonderful, and they would have 56 bases forever. And the idea that there would be a real insurgency and one that could adapt its tactics and really stand up to the American occupation in the way that the Sunni-based insurgency did, that was not in their plan. And the fact that Ayatollah Sistani came out and said, you can forget all of your hand-picked caucus system from different regions. We're going to have one man, one vote, which would have been all-American sock puppets. That's part of it. Don't let me like play that down. I didn't mean to. But he said, no, we're going to have one man, one vote. And, hey, Shia of Iraq, if you agree with me and you like God, go outside and tell the Americans that. And so they all did. And this was in January 2004. And they said, Paul Bremer and his caucus system, where America tries to create some kind of coalition government from different tribal leaders from around the country. Nope. The Shiites' time as the oppressed supermajority is over. Watch them vote for themselves. Blam. And then the Civil War was on. So, in other words, that's just one major example. But in other words, the legacy of this absolute catastrophe for the entire Middle East is mostly a legacy of failure, not a deliberate, premeditated plot to just set everything on fire. That's just the results of all of their best efforts. And look at the guys who ran the war. I mean, get drill down into the tax of watching, go back and look as carefully as you can at the record of General Casey and General Sanchez in Iraq. And these guys, they didn't know what the hell they're doing. Read through all the self-serving crap and all the crap. There's so much crap. Read between the lines and really try to get the gist of some of the truth in the Bob Woodward books about the Bush administration. And you can just see that Rice and Rumsfeld and Powell and Tenet and Bush, none of these people hardly even knew each other. Bush and Rice were friends, I guess. These people weren't working together on what all to do. I mean, the whole thing was an absolute catastrophe. Can you imagine working with Donald Rumsfeld? You're the Secretary of State, the black guy, and he's the Secretary of War, and you got Condoleezza Rice is supposed to be the referee between you to decide and then enforce her decisions about what our new plan is. None of this happened, okay? The whole thing was just a complete and total catastrophe because it had to be. It was supposed to be easy. And then, you know, yeah, do the Israelis, you know, especially the right-wing nationalists like Benjamin Netanyahu and the Likud party have a program like this? I don't know. Probably. But if you really read The Clean Break, I don't think it's that bad. But anyway, I'm sorry. Oh, man, I had a caller, but I left him on there too long. Now the music's playing. Anyway, that's my best attempted answer. On the other hand, you know, you should read the Yanan plan, and you should read Michael Ledeen faster, please. Google Michael Ledeen, Boiling Cauldron. There's some kooky stuff out there among the neocons, no doubt about it. We'll be back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right. Hey, cool. The caller called back. Maybe it's the same one. I don't know. You guys can call in too, 512-271-4836. And by the way, I don't really mean to oversimplify. I like talking all about The Clean Break. You can find The Clean Break and Coping with Crumbling States, the partner essay, both predominantly written by David Wumser, but signed off on also by Richard Pearl and Douglas Feith and Charles Fairbanks III and others. You should read all that, but you got to take it on a case-by-case basis kind of thing. And there were a lot of factors in Iraq that completely screwed up what the Republicans were trying to do there. There's just no doubt about that. On the other hand, there's no doubt that America and Israel have supported this policy of long-term no-win grind in Syria ever since it became clear that Assad was not going to fall right over. They said, that's fine, let's just keep him bogged down. They said so in the New York Times. There's no controversy about it, that's been their policy. There's no controversy that their policy has been to split off Hamas and keep Hamas as separate from the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank as possible, including just launching an entire war in order to keep them separate. But on the other hand, you wouldn't say that Israel deliberately got their asses kicked by Hezbollah in 2006, would you? that was why they forced the Syrian army out of southern Lebanon, so that they could in the future get their ass kicked by Hezbollah? Probably not, right? So some of these things are failures, and some of these things are deliberate policies of destruction. And it's not like Michael Ledeen is really in charge of any of this stuff, is he? God, I hope not. All right. Now, finally, I'm done talking for a moment because it's time for our caller to say something. Hey, you're on.
Hey, what's going on, Scott? Hey, sorry my phone is breaking up. My in car, little phone deal.
Yeah, no problem.
My kid punched it. Yeah.
Sure.
Call today. Love your show. Best show on the radio ever. Definitely.
Thanks, man.
And, I'm trying to share more people on doing everything, but, just calling to say, a couple questions. But first, I want to agree. I definitely think we'll have Marines or ground troops in, Iraq, most likely. I think before even Thanksgiving, maybe even before Halloween, I see a couple weeks. I think there's going to be something going off, soon that'll send everybody over, especially talking to family and random people at work about ISIS. And it's kind of ridiculous how scared everybody is about them, you know, thinking they're, you know, like you always say, oh, you know, they're the next, you know, Nazis, and they're going to take over the world, or try to take over the world and all that BS and everything, which isn't going to happen. My first question is, besides the Marines, if they went in, what do you think, or how would you feel if we were to send first in a larger force of private military companies in, like Blackwater? I know they changed their name and everything, but sorts of that, to where we wouldn't physically have any of our volunteer recruits on the ground, but if the government paid to have a decent amount of private military forces sent over there to try to
I think it would be wrong morally and strategically and tactically and everything else for all the very same reasons. It would make no difference than sending the Marines, the Army, or Blackwater, sending the Ethiopian Army, or whatever. At that point, they're all just proxies of Uncle Sam. Simple as that.
Yeah, I agree. I think I don't think we should be over there at all, even with airstrikes. But
now, on the other hand, somebody sent me a link this morning about this guy. You may have heard of him. There's a Huffington Post article about him. Let me see if I can find it here, man. I may have lost the dang thing. Here he is. What happened when Wisconsin man Jordan Mattson decided to take on ISIS? And it's this, he's an Iraq War veteran. Or no, he's not. He's an Army veteran, but he wasn't overseas. And then he just decided he was sick of this crap. He went and joined up with the Kurds. I guess he checked with the State Department. They told him it was okay. He went and joined up with the Kurds to help fight ISIS. These guys need killing. I want to kill them. And so everybody says, God bless. You know, be careful out there. And he's laid up now with a hurt foot, but he says he's going back out as soon as he can in the Spanish Civil War style. You want to kill ISIS? Psh, you're not going to hear an objection from me other than go do it yourself. Get yourself a plane ticket, get yourself a rifle, and, you know, whatever other equipment you can bring to bear. Make sure and check with the State Department first which groups it's okay to sign up with and which groups it ain't, so it doesn't, hopefully come back to bite you. And by all means, go shoot ISIS, guys. See if I care. But just leave America out of it. That's all.
Yeah, geez, I can't believe they would allow that. And they allowed him to keep his passport. That's his citizenship. Well, I guess technically the Kurds aren't nationality signing up with them, but that seems amazing to me that they would allow it. But, wow, that's ridiculous.
Well, there's a lot of Americans who went and fought in the Spanish Civil War, and America didn't officially take a side in it when it was the communists versus the anarchists versus the fascists.
And they just allowed them to go over.
Hemingway.
Like, it's ridiculous.
Orwell. Orwell was English, but still.
Yeah. It's ridiculous so that people can go fight for, you know, as what happened with Gaza, people can go and fight for the Israeli National Army, but yet still.
Yeah, don't go fight for Hamas. You'll be in deep trouble with the USA if you do. You're right about that.
Yeah, that is amazing to me. But
yeah,
I definitely see this ISIS situation definitely escalating. And I was talking to a friend of mine, and it just makes sense now that war, obviously, previously in Iraq, wound down. Now Afghanistan's winding down, and defense companies are upset, all the contractors making so many billions mm-hmm. by trillions off all the wars, that they needed something new, and ISIS is what they want. And,
yep.
you know, 10,000 soldiers, you know, is a direct threat against the U.S., and they need those $100,000 bombs to kill, you know, a crappy Jeep with an old 50 cal and four poor fighters on it, and to keep the money flowing. And
right.
it just amazes me that this is going on.
Yeah, well, and especially that strike on the Jeep that you're talking about, that's the best footage they can show you of their, you know, compelling and awesome and winning strategy against ISIS. That, look, here we are picking off their lowest foot soldiers two at a time. What are you talking about? This is your war? What? This is supposed to accomplish
yeah,
what?
Hey,
these are the only targets they have left to hit are cars
yeah.
and trucks. What the hell?
Yeah, and even, you know, I've heard reports that, you know, they showed that footage of, you know, because they love showing all that blur, you know, the infrared footage of the F-18s of blowing up buildings and the drone footage, and, you know, makes everybody so happy. But, you know, I've heard that half the buildings were either unoccupied or were just a few people in them. But the problem's going to be if we really do start doing strikes inside against them and start killing civilians, then what? Because we're killing guys out in the middle of nowhere in the desert, but if they start trying to, you know, retake major cities and we do airstrikes, and which is inevitable, we're going to kill civilians, then what? That's just going to create a whole another
right.
mess of problems. And
I agree with you too. I think, you know, as far as it could be as soon as Halloween or Thanksgiving, why wait till New Year's sort of thing? Because everybody knows the strategy is failing all over the place. Oh, and we got background noise. I'll cut you loose, but thanks very much for the call, man. I really appreciate it. And yeah, I mean, I agree with that. That, yeah, okay. So you send in some airstrikes, you radicalize some more people to the ISIS cause, and what else do you accomplish? You can't drive them out of power with that. The only way to do that would be to just carpet bomb Mosul. To just turn it into Dresden. But you can't do that. And so what? How do you get them out of there with air power? You can't. Who are you gonna send in? The Peshmerga? You gonna send in the sack Mosul? How long, PR-wise, can the Republicans allow the Democrats to continue allowing Baghdadi to exist as the dictator over there in Caliph land? I don't give a crap. Don't anyone misunderstand me or spin it. Baghdadi is the least threatening state leader in the world. Any European nation could kick America's ass far worse than anything that this coup could bring to bear from the crappiest part of Iraq, really. And you know what, again, I gotta do it all the time, right? Go get a map and go look at the area they call the Islamic State, and then sit down and name all of their neighbors all the way around the clock there and see how they're completely landlocked, surrounded by enemies. Not much of a position of strength at all. Best thing they got going for them is the equipment they stole from George W. Bush. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, it's the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking about the war over there. And yeah, to the caller's point about, yeah, American troops coming soon. Just look at what's happening right now on the border there. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they can outsource it. I guess they're working with some Kurdish rebels there. Maybe they have American special forces on the ground now helping laze targets. Or maybe they just dropped some laser pointers to some Kurdish fighters or something. I don't know. They're hitting some targets there, but a few tanks, this and that. I don't know. I guess, let me see. I should look up, what's her name again here? Is it Jenna? I don't remember how to spell it. Is it G-E-N-A-G-E-A-N-A? Crap. I don't remember the name of the Oh, I know. I just searched for the Kobani there. It'll come up here. Let's see. There are reporters. I guess they're now on the Turkish side of the line there. 14 minutes ago from AFP, jihadists seized Kurdish headquarters in Syria's Kobani. Hundreds trapped, warns UN. Now here's one of the reporters I was looking for here. Harold Dornbos. Let's see what we got going on his Twitter feed here. There are no Western forward air controllers with YPG inside Kobane, which makes usage of air power in and around city much less effective. Well, there's the answer to that question. Oh, no. Pro-ISIS sources compare a picture from Kobane, Syria, with famous flag raising at Iwo Jima. Them putting up the flag on the mountain there. Yeah, well, the Iwo Jima thing was a very carefully staged photo op, take six or something. Not, I think, give these ISIS guys a chance. They'll match American shtick, pound for pound, fight for fight. Big danger for YPG is ISIS trying to capture Syrian side of Kobane Crossing. If ISIS does, YPG cut off from Turkey and surrounded on four sides by ISIS. YPG being the fighters who, I don't know if what difference they are from the PKK or not or what. But anyway, local Kurdish resistance fighters in this case anyway. Pro-ISIS account claims suicide bomber targeted today, Kurdish YPG in center was a Tunisian jihadist, brother Abdul Mahmoud al-Tanuzi, which, by the way, I don't think we actually had a chance to cover this, but there was a Kurdish suicide bomber, a female Kurdish suicide bomber attacked the ISIS jihadists and killed 10 of them. Ah, didn't see that coming, did you? But I thought it was all about Islamic extremism. Maybe only not so much. Jenan, J-E-N-A-N. That's how you spell it. Jenan Musa, M-O-U-S-S-A. Jenan Musa. She's a reporter for Alan.tv. Also reporting from over there, a good source. So the whole city has not fallen yet, but I guess everyone seems to report that it's just a matter of time. Here from the Daily Beast, she links to Air Force pilots say they have no ISIS targets to bomb. These guys, what are they supposed to be, stupid and just drive around in tanks and pickup trucks when they have American B-1 bombers overhead? Get out of your tank. Run. There's a B-1 bomber coming, they all say to each other. And then do so. So now they're on foot with AKs. If they got strategy and command and control on the ground, they could still take over a city, depending on their numbers and depending on the strength of the other side, of course. But Air Force pilots say they're flying blind against ISIS here at the Daily Beast. They got nobody to shoot, and they don't have boots on the ground to laze targets for them, so they don't know what all they got to kill. The kill chain is very convoluted, one combat-experienced Air Force A-10 Warthog pilot told the Daily Beast. So here they do even have A-10s on the ground. Jeez, it seems like they would just have them fly around looking for armor to shoot, no? What's so hard about that? I mean, A-10s are basically armored planes. Pretty hard to take down. It seems like they would just find them with their eyes, but what the hell do I know about flying planes? Not much, I guess. Well, let's see here. The A-10 pilot said if a Predator drone finds a target, it can take warplanes like a B-1 or a F-15 up to 2 hours sometimes to arrive at the target area. Oftentimes, the target is simply gone by then. Yep. And why is that? That's because Turkey, our great NATO ally, won't let us use the Incirlik airbase to attack. So they got to come from the Mediterranean Sea or the Persian Gulf. Fly for hours and hours just to turn around. What a disaster it's set for Lockheed and Chase. JP Morgan, Chase, Citigroup. I conflate. I admit it. But anyway, so that's why there's going to be troops, is because air power can't do it. Everybody knows that. So they have stated a mission and a policy that does not match the mission whatsoever. So now it's just a question of making the actual mission, the actual, you know, strategy in the war, match the stated goal. Actually blow up these guys so that they're not running the place anymore. Obama said in his very first statement on this in June, out front of the White House, in front of the helicopter, about to take off, he said, "We will not allow there to be a safe haven for terrorists in Iraq." That was it, right there. You may have missed it. It was the blank check. That was all he needed right there. He said it. America clicked its heels. There will not be a safe haven for terrorists in the Sunni triangle of Iraq, combined now with eastern Syria, in a land ruled by a bin Ladenite, from his balcony declaring himself the leader of all Muslims in the world. And there's going to be no safe haven for any angry Sunni with a rifle anywhere in Sunnistan. That's Obama's promise. Not just that he'll root out the state of Baghdadi and the Islamic State, regime change him from power, abolish his army, de-ISISify his government, but that then, somehow, send John Podhoretz to be the commandant of the death camp and just bring all Sunni fighting-aged males to die. That's one way to do it. I don't know, though. The General Assembly of the UN Security Council might vote a resolution against it or something, you know? I don't know if Americans would care. I don't mean to give power any bad ideas. I really don't know. It's like Will Griggs talking about on the show earlier. We got the world's worst kind of bigot spreading the world's stupidest anti-Muslim propaganda and getting away with it. Not being shouted down, not being denounced, talking like Nazis about killing them all in polite society. That's a problematic problem, man. War's been going on too long. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. Well, I'm Scott. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Hey, here's a question of the day for this audience. You think the policy is still to get rid of Assad? Do you think they've even decided what the hell their policy is? What do you think's going on there? I mean, the way I break it down, you probably heard me say, on one hand, and never mind obviously peace or reason or libertarianism, but I just mean within the arguments of the imperial setting, they could ally with Assad or at least leave him the hell alone, since they declared war on his enemies in ISIS and pseudo in al-Nusra, but it's going to come to that, seems like. Or they could stick with completely crazy, which has been the policy as of lately, which is to support the rebellion against Assad. And that's what they've said they still plan to do. Not these guys or those guys or those guys, but we're going to vet the rebels like here we are 3 years ago in the past 3 years. So I want to know if you still think they're stupid and or crazy and or bribed by the Israelis and or the Saudis enough to still and or the Turks enough to really still want to get rid of Assad, even though that would amount to the highest of high treason on behalf of Big Daddy Baghdadi. And I'm in hiding in a basement Zawahiri over there in Pakistan. Accidentally being bin Laden's indispensable ally is one thing. But deliberately acting as the indispensable ally of the Mujahideen, that seems to me problematically problematic. And it could be that reason has already prevailed, and it's not even really a question. But I wonder what you think about that. Reason would still, of course, in this case, be a horrible option. Siding with Assad is still evil and still will blow up in her face, and our U.S. government has no right to do so in any case whatsoever. But I'm just saying, for argument's sake, there's evil policy, and then there's absolutely insane, treasonous, madness policy. You see the distinction I'm trying to make. Not much of one, but... 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Are they still working to get rid of Assad? Or de facto alliance from here on? Because, come on. I mean, at this point, it's come to a head, right? I don't know. 512-271-4836. If you want to talk about that. But, yeah, I mean, the whole war is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. So, that's the whole thing, is, barring Western intervention, the quickest way to get rid of the Islamic State as a powerful force in Sunnistan is to let everything be right now. None of their neighbors have the power to really dislodge them, but they don't have the power to overrun any of their neighbors at this point either. Kirkuk may be up for dispute, but that would have to wait anyway, I think. I think that's a bit out of ISIS's reach, and I think they probably would concede that, but I don't know. For now, I think they would rather make a deal with the Kurds than fight them. It'd be smarter. Anyway, the Islamic State, they've attempted to foist their rule on a bunch of people who, if they don't already hate their guts, will hate their guts tomorrow or the next day. We're talking about Al-Qaeda guys here. And they are, yeah, they're monsters. Go ahead and dehumanize them. They're freaking sickos. They mass murder their prisoners because it's fun to do so. And, oh yeah, blah, 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 justification and whatever crap they say. And we've seen this happen before. It wasn't David Petraeus that turned the tide against the Zarqawiites. I mean, first of all, it was Matthew Alexander that flipped a local Iraqi against Zarqawi, the Jordanian bin Ladenite. And he did so not by torturing the guy, but by making friends with him. That's not his real name, Matthew Alexander, but we know his story anyway. That's his pseudonym. He didn't torture the guy. He said, look, man, this Jordanian Zarqawi, he's gotten you guys in a civil war with the Shia. You can't win here, pal. Something like that. He spoke reason to the man. Don't you think something bad ought to happen to this Zarqawi guy now? And he got the guy, to the local Iraqi, to agree with him that, yeah, you know what? Exploding Zarqawi probably would be a nice turn of events. Here's where to go explode him. That's how they got the dime on Zarqawi, right there in the first place. So I guess you could chalk that success up to one man in the U.S. Army right there. But then it was the entire Iraqi Sunni tribal system that turned on the Al-Qaeda guys, and they didn't have to be bribed by Petraeus to do it. All Petraeus did was show up after almost a year straight of this activity and then bribe them to keep it up and continue doing the same thing, and here's a little bit of help too. But the Sunni awakening was invented by the Sunnis, not by David Petraeus, the tribal council, Sons of Iraq, concerned local citizens, and all that crap. That was not invented by the Americans. It was invented by the Iraqi Sunnis. And why? Because the Al-Qaeda guys were jerks, bossing them around, way out of their jurisdiction. You know what? Somebody recommended to me, and I never did get around to it, and then I'm glad I finally did get back to it and watch the whole thing. It came out originally in parts, but now it's one big movie. You can watch it at Vice.com. Their reporters spent a lot of time with the Islamic State, and you can see these guys for what they are in Syria, and I think some footage in Iraq as well, and they suck. They're like the worst sort of right-wing Republican. They're goofballs. They're so would-be totalitarian, you know? And, you know, it's true that there are, I don't know, the Iranian Islamist regime, despite their overbearing nature, has been able to, and maybe because of their overbearing nature, has been able to maintain their grip on power. But even then, I think mostly that's in the face of imperial, unlimited imperial threats toward them all the time, rallying the people around the mullahs. But in Iraq, at least, I mean, first of all, in Syria, we've never seen guys like this rule eastern Syria before. No reason to think they would now, not in the modern era. No reason to think they would last there. And we've seen exactly the local Sunnis turn on these guys before, and why? And it was because they're all basically a bunch of Zarqawis. Way too big for their britches, killing way too many innocent civilians, banning smoking. And I ain't never been to Syria, but I think one of the only things that I know for a fact about Syria is they like smoking. And so, you know, people don't like that kind of thing. Like, I'm a former smoker, but I still kind of extra double despise liberals and Democrats for just that issue. Look, it's your damn business whether other people smoke cigarettes. What? 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 That's madness. Who came up with that? Anyway, so these guys are like, they're the very worst kind of, you know, Pat Robertson's right-wing religious police, if he had them, combined with, you know, Mayor Bloomberg's liberal do-gooder righteousness coming from the other end, too, with suicide attacks and conscription. And as Patrick Coburn said, he had his sources in Iraq told him that when ISIS came to town, they said, hey, what's your daughter's name and how old is she? Because some of our fighters need wives. Not like, whoa, we would like to introduce them and perhaps consider a courtship. You know. Yeah, we might be taking your daughter with us, they said as they rode into town. And every Iraqi cocked his AK-47. So, you can see there's kind of a... There's plenty of reason to believe that this conflict could work itself out. They can't go into Turkey any more than Erdogan wants to let them into Kurdistan, I guess, in Turkey, but Turkish Kurdistan, I mean, but they have, the Turks have more than enough power to keep them south. The Kurds can keep them south and out of Kurdistan. The Shiite militias and so-called Iraqi army with Iranian help can keep them out of Baghdad, probably Samarra. Obviously, Karbala and Najaf, the Shiite shrine cities and all that will be protected. Baghdad will hold. It'll be attacked, but it'll hold under Shiite control. And they can't go to Jordan or, you know, further in Syria, doesn't look like. So they're hemmed in. So let them rot. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Ha, Fox News just got busted plagiarizing Mitchell Prothero. Oh, no, they're not plagiarizing him. They say McClatchy. I guess the point of the tweet was just they're falling way behind here. And, you know, yeah, ISIS is in Baghdad, in the southwestern neighborhoods. They have a presence in those Sunni neighborhoods that are still Sunni in the southwest corners of Baghdad. I don't know. Landay seemed to think that the Shiites might have trouble holding on to Baghdad, but I don't think so. In fact, I read a piece by the War Nerd over there at Pando, and I like the War Nerd, even though he's a terribly amoral bastard. He is really great. I read his whole book, and he's great on every conflict on Earth. I mean, not that I agree with him, but he knows all about it, and he writes all about it in a hilarious way, and he's an evil son of a bitch, but anyway. And he had this great article, actually, about Shiite control of Baghdad and what idiots all these idiots were for saying how, oh my god, ISIS is about to take Baghdad. And he actually starts off, did I already say this on the radio? I don't think so. He starts off like John Cusack with a cartoon of a jihadist in a full ninja costume with only his eyes showing. And he's holding up, jambox over his head like John Cusack saying, oh, wham, I'm lonely and I miss you kind of thing. And as though he's on the outskirts of Baghdad, wishing he had Baghdad back, which he lost. And yeah, lost. That was what the Iraq War accomplished. That was what the noble cause was. Quote unquote noble. Scare quotes noble. Noble cause was that George Bush invoked in the case of the death of Casey Sheehan. He didn't want to be too specific, but that's what they really did, was kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. As the war nerd puts it, I think he doesn't emphasize America's role in serving as the useful sock puppet idiot dupes of the Bada Brigade in this case. There's a lot of that. That's what they did. That was what George Bush, that was the mission accomplished in Iraq. By the end of 08, the Sunnis had been kicked out of Baghdad. As the war nerd puts it, the Shiites took the city street by street. I wish he had mentioned, I don't think he mentions their use of power drills in the heads of any Sunnis who got caught on the wrong side of the line who resisted them. And the piles of bodies of people who are even alleged to be Sunnis found in Baghdad, 3,000 people being killed a month just in the capital city in the spring and summer of 2007. Brutal sectarian war. And, I mean, it had already been going on since Rumsfeld started the El Salvador option in 2005 with that guy James Steele and hiring the Bada Brigade to go out and try to hunt and kill the leaders of the Sunni-based insurgency then. But it really, that was what the surge accomplished, if anything, was help the Shiites win their civil war against the Sunnis that they denied that it was even happening. That they said their goal was to bring the Sunnis into the government. And eventually they did, only a little, but only while America was still there making them do it. Only while Petraeus himself was still there making them do it, and really paying for it himself in the name of Iraq. Anyway, so in other words, you can have the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, Bin Ladenite, suicide bomber dudes on the outskirts to the southwest of Baghdad. But that doesn't mean they can march on Baghdad. That doesn't mean they can take Baghdad. And you know what's funny in there? The war nerd cites the idiots over at the American Thinker blog as saying, oh no, Islamic State is about to take Baghdad. And he's like, yeah, great. Only an idiot would even name his site that in the first place. And I forgot his turn of phrase, but, you know, just about how stupid these idiots are. They don't know anything. But I wanted to add to that because I don't think the war nerd quite understands that. Actually, the American Thinker was one of the worst pro-war blogs online during the whole Bush war over there. In other words, if they had learned the first thing about the war they promoted all along and helped lead online, not just support for the war, but any kind of attacks against those who would oppose it, trying to tire us all with their crap. And here they are in 2014 over there. They had no idea whether or not the Islamic State can march right into Baghdad or not. Well, they march right into Mosul and to Crete and Fallujah because they were welcome there. You think they're welcome in Baghdad? Over there, the American Thinker that supported the war all along, including the ethnic cleanse, sectarian cleansing of all the Sunnis out of the capital city, they have no idea. Yeah, well, good job, guys. Point is, they can do suicide attacks and they can do, you know, raids, I guess, here and there. They may be able to fire off some artillery at Baghdad, but no, the Sunnis can't take it. Not without state help from a source that ain't in this war somewhere. Let the Martians come and help them. Otherwise, the Sunni war to take back Baghdad will take 100 years or something, if it ever succeeds. Probably won't. That was the one big change. And yeah, the Bada Brigade and Mahdi Army monsters, especially the Bada Brigade guys, and the Wolf Brigade, which was just the special forces basically made up from the Bada Brigade of the Iranian sock puppet Supreme Islamic Council. They're the most brutal torturers. And you can read about how murderers. And you can read in the Chelsea Manning heroically leaked Iraq war logs all about how the Americans tortured these guys, and the Americans worked with the Bada Brigade to torture these guys and knowingly handed them over all the time to the Bottom Brigade to torture these guys. And Donald Rumsfeld had ordered it. There was a frago, whatever the hell, fragmentary order. Was it 242 or something? Like that old techno band? I forgot. I think it was, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, and that fragmentary order said, hey, if the local Iraqi, quote-unquote authorities, the Shiite militia guys, are torturing and murdering these guys, don't do anything about it. Let it stand. And Rumsfeld even said that in a press conference. Yeah, no, our policy is that's none of our damn business. And he was corrected by, I think it was General Franks, said, that's not true. Our job is to stop that. We cannot, you know, he understands the Geneva Conventions and maybe was under the impression that they could possibly ever be applied to him somehow or something. I don't know where he ever got that idea. But he said, no, soldiers should not be doing that, Mr. Secretary of Defense, and contradicted him right there on the TV there. Which normally, I don't like that stuff so much. But, you know, the men in uniform contradicting the men in the pinstripe suits. But it's a special case. Anyway, but the American military did participate in that for a long, long, long time, including how they would kill these guys with power drills. And you'll hear me say that all the time, kind of, because I just can't get over how brutal that is. Can you imagine that? I mean, what the hell kind of horror movie do they kill people with power drills through the eyeballs and through the head, through the shoulders and arms and legs and torso to death? Can you imagine that? With a DeWalt? For crying out loud, man. And by the way, by intervening in this war against ISIS, those are the guys we're allying with, again. The Iranians and their sock puppets. The Bada Brigade, the Mahdi Army, Aseib al-Haq, and what was the other one? Fatah something, the other Shiite militia down there near Basra. These guys are just as evil, only on the other side. And by allying with them, that'll make our difficulties with the Sunni population under the Islamic State that much worse by bringing the Quds force and their auxiliaries into battle against them. So have a nice damned war. It's going to be a complete and total catastrophe. And, you know, I kind of want to shut up about it because I don't want to sound like I'm encouraging it. And I don't want to, like, taint the atmosphere out there somewhere with my Heisenberg uncertainty principle all the time predicting full-scale invasion. Everybody says they don't want to invade. But I'm just trying to go down the list of who are they going to get to do it for them then? And the answer is nobody. And so what does that leave you with? So, I sure don't mean to make matters worse or anything, but looks like we're going to have a full-scale George W. Bush-style invasion, at least of Sunnistan, you know? And they're going to have to get there from Kuwait. Oh, that was what I was going to say, too. It's in my notes from when the caller called in. They already just sent an entire detachment, I don't know how many men, to Kuwait, Marines, to Kuwait, to get ready. So, see, I told you before Mosul ever fell, I'm sending the Marines after these guys soon. Anyway, that's the bad news for this week. It's fun drive, so I've got no KPFK show this Sunday, but I'll see y'all back here Monday. Thanks very much for listening. Y'all appreciate it.